This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Hey everybody, we're back with another Bald Movies podcast. We found out that it's going to be tomorrow, the 40th anniversary of
December
The Godfather
20th.
Part 2. 1974 is when this thing came out. So we decided we're going to cover both The Godfather, which we've already done, and if you haven't checked that out, go search around on our site for it, or look a little back in the stream for this one. This is the previous episode.
Yeah, it's pretty easy to get to. You go to the homepage, hit podcast, Bald Movies, boom, it's there.
Yep. So we did that on Monday, and now we're back for Godfather Part 2. This movie, what do you think? I mean, is it as good as Godfather 1? I know we want to talk about this at the end.
Well, let's, yeah.
But what did you think of this movie kind of by itself?
I think this movie is awesome. It's fun to think about this world in a movie where The Godfather doesn't exist. Like, if you just saw Godfather 2,
okay,
you would probably think it's one of the best movies you've ever seen. And
sure,
it is. It's much more complex, in my opinion. It's much darker. It's equally well made. Maybe slightly less accessible because it does require quite a bit of attention from the audience. Like, it's easy to get lost, and it has a lot of Michael just showing his process rather than talking about it. I mean, a couple of crucial points in the movie, he talks about his process of how he deduces. It's kind of like if you ever wanted to know how The Godfather, you know, in the original movie, sussed out that it was Barzini and not Tattaglia and all that kind of stuff. This is Michael kind of a movie-long investigation on who is trying to fuck him.
Yeah, pretty much.
And how he needs to settle that. And I think it's fascinating.
I do too.
You know, I've already said, so it's kind of a little bit of a spoiler, but for the longest time, I didn't get The Godfather 2.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was almost offended when people said it was good or as good or even superior to the first Godfather. Mm-hmm. Now, my opinion's been changing. The last two or three times I watched this movie, I think it helped because the last time before I watched this, I watched it just out of the blue. No, usually I watch a Godfather and then the next day or that evening I'll watch Godfather 2 and my opinion just gets reinforced. I just watched Godfather 2 for no good reason one day and found myself really getting involved in the plot, and it kind of changed my opinion of the movie. What did you think?
So all of the things that you just said are essentially what Francis Ford Coppola thinks of this film as well. He thinks it is a little bit darker. It is can be hard for some people to follow, but at the same time, it's more intricate for a reason. And I don't want to talk too much about, you know, what I think as compared to Godfather 1, but I feel like that's the context in which I judge this movie, so it's hard not to.
Yeah.
I'm going to save a lot of what I thought of it for the end.
Okay.
I think it is a great film on its own. But I'm going to leave the verdict for the end.
This is going to be a very different podcast from the first one. The first one, you know, I feel like I have all the answers for The Godfather. And I've also done a lot of reading and studying of the history, and I had, like, you know, some little things I could bring up to the attention to the production. Mm-hmm. I don't have a lot of that for Godfather 2.
Okay, well, I watched
and
the
I think we're
going to
talk a lot more about, like, the concepts and the plot points and play some mm-hmm. what if and just kind of, like, be more fanboys on this
sure.
one.
Sure, because we are fanboys of the Godfather series.
Sure.
I don't know about 3. I've never seen 3. Maybe we'll get to that
I'm very curious. I think we should watch it together and then do an instant take podcast on it.
Okay.
Because how rare is it to find 2 30-something dudes that loved the Godfather movies that have never seen Godfather 3? The reason I've never seen Godfather 3 is because I have such respect for material, and the mm-hmm. universal opinion is it's a terrible affront to the franchise.
Yeah.
It's not Return of the Jedi. It's Attack of the Clones.
Yeah, and Coppola talks about that a little bit, too. In the Godfather Part 2 commentary, he's like, I was super resistant to the idea of Godfather Part 3.
Hmm.
He talks a little bit about it in the scene where, you know, they're taking Fredo out in the boat to kill him near the end.
I was super concerned. I was super surprised to see an opinion that I read in an article from 2008 that said Coppola regrets making any sequels. I would not be surprised if he regretted making the third one, mm-hmm. but, you know, when he said, I include the second, it was an unnecessary movie to make. I wish I didn't do it. That's shocking to me.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, the story is... So the story is different. The story is a continuation, certainly, of The Godfather, especially for Michael, you know? I mean, in The Godfather Part 1, he becomes his father. In The Godfather Part 2, we see that he's not quite his father. He is in some ways, but in the end, he loses his family, and that's kind of the crux of this movie.
Even though he has so many of the strengths and so many of the weaknesses of his old man, and that's the kind of brilliant thing about the parallel structure of this movie.
Yes,
showing them both building up to arguably totally unnecessary assassinations.
Sure. Do you think that when Paramount said, Coppola, Godfather Part 2... they were expecting a longer movie than the first one, which is essentially, in some ways, 4 movies.
Like, yeah, you're right.
It's 2 movies that are roughly like 1 hour 40 each, but it's also like structured in a way that there are 2 halves to those 2 movies.
Uh-huh.
I imagine that Paramount was like, oh, God, what is this behemoth becoming before it was all said and done?
Mm-hmm.
But then the end product is fantastic.
Interesting.
Like The Godfather 1, once I start watching this movie, I'm so drawn into the world that they're creating
mm-hmm.
and the characters that I don't realize that 3 hours and 22 minutes have gone by at the end of it.
Yeah. I remember thinking when the intermission first came up, we were watching it the other day. It's like, Jesus, we have a whole other movie to watch.
Yeah, the intermission is 2 hours in.
And not in a, like, oh, God, this movie's so long, like Hobbit type of way. It's in a totally, wow, I can't believe we've gotten this much plot and this much depth. One thing I want to talk about in terms of, you know, people talk about the golden age of television and how it surpassed the movies.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And
let's talk about
it. It's easy. So, like, you want to talk about that now?
Yeah.
Let's talk about that now.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty easy argument to make that Breaking Bad has more depth, complexity, character development, et cetera, in its, 70 hours of television, roughly?
Around there, yeah.
Than most movies have at their 2-hour running time.
Mm-hmm.
Godfather 2 is a rare exception to where. I feel like in the 3.5 hours that you watch it, you could not pack more character development, complexity of plot, or themes, or art.
I would mostly agree with you, but then there's the exceptions of, like we talked about in The Godfather 1, the transitions, which are 1.5 minutes long of a guy walking.
That's what I'm saying. You could cut those out, but you would also diminish the art and the the mood. So,
yes,
like,
yeah.
I was just saying, like, it's
really
the maximum density when you try to respect character, story, and art.
Yeah, I am so thoroughly impressed by the texture of these films. I mean, you go back to, you can tell the difference just by looking at it of, you know, the 1917 sections or the 1958 sections just by looking at it. They do such a great job. And I think that care is taken on purpose. Because yeah. if you go and you look at, you know, just the old section being 99% in Italian and subtitled, that lends a feeling to the film, to that portion of the film, that I feel like you wouldn't get if they were all just speaking English, right?
Sure.
I mean, you want to get in there and say, okay, these people are fresh off of a boat from Italy.
Sure.
They're not speaking English. They're speaking Italian, and it just doesn't feel right if they're not.
Yeah.
And that's what he does so well, is he takes... I mean, he's a guy who grew up with a father who was part of this whole thing, right? Uh-huh. Like, who did immigrate over, and... Like, he's got a lot of that culture instilled in him.
Uh-huh.
So when he makes his movies, that really comes through. And I don't think he could make a movie this good without being centrally involved in that sort of thing.
And I like how you say the omnipresent Italian and the subtitling makes the audience identify with the immigrant culture because they're now the outsiders.
Sure.
You know, imagine yeah. if you lived in that world where and there weren't any yeah. subtitles. You uh-huh. know, that's like
Oh, it's interesting because I watched the commentary and they don't do subtitles on the commentary. So
sure.
when I'm watching it and Francis Ford Coppola is not talking, uh-huh. and they're all speaking Italian. I mean, granted, I've seen it, so I know what's going on, but you
right.
can kind of still tell. But it's
yeah, yeah.
so much harder to tell
yeah.
exactly what's happening.
So it's interesting how they use that technique to make it, number one, a more authentic, richer experience, but also a little bit. I think, put the audience into that role of the immigrant.
Sure.
Surrounded in this culture that they don't understand, and they're kind of feel vulnerable. That's another thought I had making when I'm watching this movie is, you know, it seems like there's a lot of crime and corruption that thrives within these immigrant cultures.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like the gangs in New York, it wasn't Italian, it was then the Irish, right?
Gangs in New York? I think so, yeah.
And, you know, here we talk Italians now, it's like you hear about a lot about the Russian mob and the you know, South American cartels
mm-hmm.
and they're entering our society. It seems, and you're like, why? Why would you go to a godfather than police or to judges or whatnot? But it starts to make sense in these kind of enclaves
mm-hmm.
that... You know, when you've got this mafia who gives you, if you play along with the system, you get nothing but good things.
Uh huh. You get rugs.
You get rugs.
Uh-huh.
And if you go against it, you get violence and arson and death.
Yeah.
Everyone just goes along with it, and especially when you feel like you are being taken advantage of the system, that the police and the judges are not there to serve your interest against the majority.
Yeah.
Institutions like the mafia seem to make sense. And also institutions like the mafia seem to crumble when those populations become integrated into society. Because now, all of a sudden, these, you know, 3-4 generations go by, Italian-Americans are integrated in society. They got, you know, they are judges and policemen. They don't need the mafia
yeah, yeah.
anymore. And mm-hmm. they start losing their stranglehold. So
sure. makes sense.
I think it's interesting. And it's always, I think it's insightful. When you think about these things in terms of our current immigration debate, you know, it's fascinating in the last 100, probably 200 years of this country, how many cycles of, you know, xenophobia and racism and being scared of immigrants, it just
yeah,
keeps repeating.
I feel like that's the human comedy is just not learning from our mistakes in the past.
Well, I think it's also a testament to how deep wired that fear of other is into our
certainly,
our biology.
Yeah. We're a tribal species.
Like, we want to, if we don't have a tribe, we want to find and form one. And
yeah.
once we do, then fuck everybody else.
Sure.
And that's kind of like when I enjoy The Wire, partially because of its social commentary. There's a lot of subtle social commentary about this, you know, crime and family and what it means to belong in society and what it means to be outside of society and whether that's good or bad. One of the things I thought was interesting about Roger Ebert's reviews of The Godfather is he seems very uncomfortable with how much admiration the audience feels towards, especially Vito.
Okay.
But also
yeah.
that we're kind of rooting for Michael too in these criminal or and it's like, you know, I feel like part of his review kind of negative. I mean, as negative as a 3-star review of a movie can get.
3 stars, huh?
He gave 3 out of 4-star scale.
Is that thumbs? That's Stars.
That's Stars.
He, okay. He didn't have Siskel there for the extra thumbs.
No, no, no. His newspaper's articles have always been written with a 4-star review. Right. So it's a 3-star movie.
Really?
And he never backs away from that. He says, you know, when he rewrote his great movies review, he's like, I don't back away from any of that stuff. But the only thing I've changed is over the decades, I now see Godfather 2 as a companion piece to The Godfather, so it by nature that elevates the material to status of great movies.
I see. So it's kind of they go together separately. They're not as good as the sum of their parts together.
He compared it like gospels in the Bible. Like, there's not all the gospels are as good.
Are any of them good?
But, well, I mean, I'm just saying, like, you know, not all the Gospels are as good as the others as far as terms of writing, how much information you get about Jesus.
But you can't separate them.
But you can't, you can't say, well, I'm only going to, I think John is the best and everything else is crap. You have to kind of consider them roughly as a unit.
That's kind of where I come from on The Godfather 2. I think, like I said earlier, it's a continuation of the story. It's a film that I ultimately don't know that it needed to be made. But after having been made, I think it was worthy of being made. Because I feel like you could have left Godfather 1 where it was and said, look at this foreboding sense that it gives you at the end as to Michael's future, and kind of inferred the rest of this stuff. But seeing it play out on the screen is also entertaining and fun.
Some people... Ebert was one of them, but I was reading Rotten Tomatoes. Rotten Tomatoes is great if you want to just see a bunch of historical reviews of movies and how people's opinions of it have changed over time. I think it's interesting that his opinion was they should have ditched all the Vito stuff from this one and just concentrated on Michael.
Oh, no.
My first initial reaction when I saw Godfather 2 was like, I really liked the Vito stuff. I kept getting annoyed switching back to Michael and not giving, because Michael's less likable, less relatable, and less interesting in my mind, you know, 10 years ago when I first saw that.
Okay.
Obviously, I think I've come a little bit around to that.
Roger Ebert said that?
Yes.
I completely disagree.
Do you think?
I say these two storylines are inseparable.
Okay.
And without the other one, without one, the other doesn't work. And I think those are interchangeable.
So. The plot of the Vito's rise to power largely came right from Mario Puzo's novel, The Godfather.
Yeah.
Like that's all, again, the novel is the rise of the Don. In the movie, it's the fall of the Don, rise of Michael.
Yeah.
90%+ of that material came from the book. The Michael stuff was all new.
Yeah.
So I don't know that they're inseparable, but the way that Coppola has structured that, it's easy to make that argument.
Yeah, I mean, Coppola in the commentary says that he when he was making it, he saw that he was making two separate movies.
And he was. Cast, location,
he
everything.
Was. Yeah, Robert De Niro and Al Pacino only appear on screen together one time, and it's because of a crossfade that they're doing.
Right.
They're never in the same location.
Right.
Which obviously makes sense.
Sure.
But he said once he started looking at it, the movies by themselves were just okay. When he put them together in a certain way, it made them great, in his opinion. And I totally agree with that.
But I feel like that...
I think it's a juxtaposition of who Michael is and who his father was that really make this film work well.
And I feel like I appreciate Vito more knowing where he came from. I mean... Yeah, his mother considered him dumb and dull-witted. He rarely spoke. You take this boy
and
you put him you put him on a boat, and he's 9 years old.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, like, so that's a year older than my son is. I take my son, and he speaks not a lick of English. I put him on a boat to America.
Uh-huh.
And, like, then 15 years from then, he becomes Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
And makes his way through New York City and gets exposed to... I mean, there's a lot of fun what-if questions. Like, what if Clemenza was not his next-door neighbor?
Yeah, I don't know that he gets in that.
He gets fired. Does he
go look for another job?
This is actually a broader question of if Vito had been fired, or when did Vito become the Godfather, or choose to become the Godfather? Was it when he first saw Don Finucci and saw how he was kind of like taking advantage of his fellow immigrants rather than trying to help them? Like he was that Don was more of a leech. I feel like Vito was much more of a guardian.
Yeah, no, you're right. I would say the same thing about Michael. He's different from Vito in that same way. I feel like Michael uses his family more as like a tool versus Vito, which had like genuine affection for the people around him.
But is that they all had similar formable events. Like Vito's father was murdered at a very young age.
His whole family.
Michael's father was murdered or attempted murdered at not a very young age, but you know, he's still a young man. Mm-hmm. And those that did a lot to form them, but they turned out into two different people. Like Michael is paranoid.
Yeah.
Vito was never paranoid. He was always generous, open-hearted, cunning, careful, but he was never paranoid that way.
No. And I don't know. I can't ever see Vito getting in the scenario that Michael is in this movie.
Where his own brother tries to kill him?
Yeah.
Well, his brother got murdered after his father, so yeah. No,
I mean, their personalities are so different.
But why? Because why do you say that? Because Vito would have handled Fredo better?
I feel like he would have, yeah.
Another way to restate that is Vito didn't have to suffer a fool like Fredo in his inner family. Like, Fredo was his son, so he could, you know... it's much easier to deal with a lackwit son than it is a lackwit brother, I guess.
Probably, yeah, because you certainly have more authority in their eyes. But I feel like it might be a consequence of the eras in which we see Vito and Michael, because in The Godfather 1, we see Vito in an era in which he already has this extreme amount of power, and it's kind of old hat to him, right? I mean, he's had this for a very long time, but you can tell that he's loved by the community, whereas I don't feel like Michael has any of that kind of respect among people. Like, yeah, they go to him and they ask him for things, but it's not... like, he just doesn't have the way of dealing with people that his father did, like talking to them and...
Do you think it's part of this paranoia stems from him moving out to Nevada?
Uh-huh.
Like, New York City was their town. That's where their people live.
Yeah.
Nevada, they are completely outsiders.
Yeah.
The politicians don't like them. They learn to fear and use them, which we see that brilliantly with the character of Geary.
Yeah, that might be it. I mean, he just doesn't have the support of the community like Vito had.
Like his attempts to go legitimate, he was always entangled with the bad stuff that happened, the violence and the crime and the extortion from New York, and he had none of the advantages.
Yeah.
So whereas Vito could be a thug, but also generous and open-hearted, and in, you know, community and family are important. Michael left the family and the community as a way to protect his family and as a way to elevate his family legitimacy. But in doing that, that led to the seeds of his family's destruction.
Partially. I also feel like Michael just has a slightly different demeanor than his father. He's similar in a lot of ways, but like, I can't see Michael schmoozing at a wedding like we see with Vito. You know, it doesn't feel right when Michael is out there laughing it up with his family and having a good time. Whereas Vito, I feel like he goes out into that wedding, he's just friendly father. You know?
Yeah, I mean, Frank Pentangeli.
Uh-huh.
I just probably butchered that. Frankie Five Angels.
Sure.
Has to wait till late at night to see Michael, whereas Vito took care of all the business before he joined and enjoyed his daughter's wedding, and that was at his son's you know, first communion, I guess, confirmation.
Something like that.
So I think that's you're probably right. Vito would never have kept his, you know, fucking capo of his New York family waiting for that long.
I mean, even the people he didn't want to see, like Luca Brasi, when he comes in, he's like,
he gave him respect.
I don't want to see this guy, but let's see him.
I'm giving him the respect that they deserve for their
and
loyalty.
He's just more, Vito feels more personable to me. Michael feels more closed off and unwilling to engage with people.
More reptilian.
On a human level. Yeah. Yeah. So, I don't know. That's what I think about the differences between the personalities there and how they affect the story. And ultimately, I mean, Michael does lose his family, whereas Vito never lost that. When Vito loses his family, it's to death. When Michael loses his family, it's because they hate him.
Yeah, well, and also to death.
Well, okay, he kills some of his family.
But... yeah, brother-in-law. It's hard to be Michael's brother, whether it's brother-in-law or brother.
I guess I'm judging that on the wives. Like, Kate hates Michael's guts by the end.
You can never Michael's imagine mom, Vito's mom.
Yeah, Michael's mom
or Vito's
has
wife.
Affection to this day for Vito.
Sure, sure.
So... that says it all, in my opinion.
And that's what was one of the interesting things about the book. I mean, they hinted in the movies the fact that, like, the Godfather was aware that Connie was getting roughed up by her husband.
Yeah.
But him and his wife's opinion was, well, you know, Connie's a shitty wife. She's a spoiled brat. She might need this kind of.
Was that their opinion?
Yeah, that was their opinion.
What tells you that? I don't remember that.
No, I'm saying for one thing, when Vito's in the hospital and they're at the dinner and Carlo tells Connie to shut up and Sonny snaps at him, like, don't you talk to my sister like that.
Yeah, yeah.
His mom says, do not interfere. Huh, that's expounded in the book where, you know, Connie comes the first time Carlo roughs him up. She comes to her father and her father's like, what do you want me to do? He's your husband.
Yeah, she goes, that's what I think it is.
And then she goes, he says, well, did you ever hit mama? And he goes, your mama never gave me reason to. And her mom just kind of smiles at her like, yeah, what are you doing?
Yeah, and that's in direct contrast to Michael getting involved in Connie's life in this episode or in this movie where he tells her, don't marry this man.
Sure.
You know, and stop your crazy ways, what you're doing.
I felt like that was... I feel like that's the way Vito might have handled it. Like, look, if you marry this man, you're going to disappoint me.
I mean, he just shows so much disrespect for everyone involved.
They also are...
I mean, he tells her this right in front of the guy.
But this is the family... I mean, yeah, but the other thing is this is the family he inherited.
Yeah.
You know, Vito didn't have a family. Vito had a family that he chose. He had, he had Clemenza, and he had Tessio. And he had his wife, and he had his children. This is the family that he built. Michael inherited this family that was fairly dysfunctional.
That's true. It was starting to become kind of broken up by the time Michael gets it.
Right. Now, what the real question was, would the Godfather ever have murdered, like, Carlo? Or we'd have found some way to co-opt him? Would he ever have murdered Fredo? Would he ever let Fredo turn into the type of person that would need to be murdered?
Sure. I mean, you can't put Carlo... I don't know if I put Carlo on Michael's plate too much because, well, first of all, I thought it was really funny or tragic kind of how who is it that introduces them? I think it's Sonny who introduces Connie and Carlo in the very last scene of this.
Yes, yes, which is
that's iron. So tragic because Carlo gets Sonny killed and ends up just destroying half of that family.
Yeah.
Super tragic, but I don't know. I don't put Carlo on Michael too much because he got Sonny killed, you know?
And it's interesting because this...
What are you going to do?
Sonny coming home with Carlo and taking him under his wing was kind of, I think, intended to be an echo of the Don taking Tom Hagen in off the streets. And look how well that worked out to the family. They got, like, another brother out of the deal.
Yeah.
Carlo was a cancer. Mm-hmm. So you're right about that. While we're talking about these characters, can we talk about Frank Pentangeli?
No, he's the only character I won't talk about.
Okay. So he's a replacement for Clemenza. The actor who played Clemenza tried to big time Coppola and said, I need to be paid like I'm Brando or something.
Yeah,
Coppola's like,
guess what? A basket of oranges every day.
Guess what, Clemenza? You had a heart attack in between movies, and now, you know, your trusted lieutenant that we never met, Frank, he's going to be taken over. And we see him.
And we scribbled out Clemenza on each of these pages and put Frankie in there.
And I always thought, it's like, God damn, this guy's such a pale shadow of Clemenza. Mm-hmm. But the more I watch it, the more I realize that's only because he is played to be a fool.
At the wedding.
At the confirmation.
Whatever it is, yeah.
But then you think of the first movie, Clemenza is this big, fat, sweaty dude dancing and drinking wine straight out of the pitcher.
The only reason he gets redemption, I feel, is the scene with the gun with Michael.
And also, he's just a badass taking care of business throughout the rest of the movie. Where we have the same thing with Frankie. I mean, I think when he first, you start to get an idea of who he is when he's in Michael's study. And he's talking about, you know, he's screaming about how, you know, these Rosato brothers are trying to run him out of New York. And your father did business with Hyman Roth, but he never trusted him. And he says, but I just want everybody to know they're going to have any trouble for me. And then he takes his leave. And then he continues to be more and more interesting right to his almost, I guess, final scene. Like, he also was a corpse in a tub. But when he's having that conversation with Tom Hagen about the old Roman emperors and plots against them. And they're
at the prison.
I mean, I think he's as good as Clemenza. Maybe, I mean, certainly not.
I think he's
not the pale imitation I initially saw when I first watched the movie.
No, I'm certainly more endeared to Frankie than I ever was to Clemenza. Clemenza seems like, you know, a guy who's all business. Frankie seems like he can get down and have a good time. Hmm. And like, especially the scene where he's conducting the music, he's trying to get them to play Italian music.
Sure.
That really endeared me to Frankie as a character. And then when I see that he's not just a buffoon, that actually lended a little more gravitas to his actions.
The real problem with this plot about the Rosato brothers and Michael wanting to lay low because he's got other plans is it feels a little Death Star too. Like, that's essentially the plot of The Godfather after, you know, Vito exited, is that Mike's trying to do something. Yeah. There's these other guys making moves against him, and he wants to lull them into sleepy time so he can take care of everything in one master stroke. This is essentially the plot to this movie as well.
Definitely. There are so many parallels in Godfather 2 to Godfather 1. That's something that Coppola was conscious of going into
this. You think that's a feature, not a bug?
Certainly. I mean, if you listen to the commentary track for this movie, he talks about, like, this scene is a parallel to this other scene in Godfather 1. And he does that multiple times throughout the movie. So he knew that he needed to take the elements of Godfather 1 and just infuse them into Godfather 2.
So the other thing I want to talk about is Hyman Roth. Well, there's tons of things I want to talk about. Hyman Roth.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
He is, and I did not know this until very recently. Until I got started getting steeped in Boardwalk Empire history, so the last couple of years. He's intended to be Meyer Lansky from Boardwalk Empire and also Real Life.
Yeah, I didn't know that until you told me.
That transforms how I see this character.
For sure.
This character is like a John Torrio type. He's a survivor. Well, he's better than John Torrio because, you know, he's playing down his old, broken old man. Hey, I'm retired. You know, I just, you know, I'm dying of this heart attack for 20 years. I don't got much time to live.
Mm-hmm.
All the while, he is still plotting for his one last score to put him on top.
What is the one last score he's doing?
Okay, so
because the one last score, it seems like an anti-score for Michael. Like, I'm just going to keep Michael from getting this casino.
Well, so
does he want to take down the whole Corleone family? Like, what does he want to do?
So there's a couple theories, because I haven't seen this enough to know. There's a couple themes. He's pissed off about Mo Green.
He is.
Mo Green was kind of like his Tom Hagen. Okay, he was like a son to him. He helped bring him up. He watched this guy build this city in the desert, and then he got offed by this upstart punk that got everything handed to him.
Sure.
And he was pissed. So there could be a long-term the revenge plot on the Corleones, and Michael in particular, just on that area.
I would buy that.
Also, Corleones have moved out of New York. So he, through his men, the Rosato brothers, he's trying to, I think, gain that back.
Yeah, the interesting thing about that is that Vito promised two neighborhoods to those guys, and Frankie was saying, those are my neighborhoods, I want them. That's where the whole beef between them got started.
And then I think the third thing is he's got this, and this has a lot of basis in historical fact, the mob and, you know, the barons of industry were planning on setting up Cuba as like a puppet government.
They're
going to have a whole country, this giant private island within a short plane ride or boat ride from the States, where they could do whatever the hell they wanted to and chase their profits and chase their money and run their rackets with no interference from the federal government.
Yeah, I think that's his final score.
But he's also wanting to cut Michael out of it, of course, as part of his overarching. But he needed Michael's
revenge. He's bitter. Yeah,
he needed Michael's influence and he needed Michael's money.
Yeah.
To pull that off. But that's where I'm a little fuzzy on. I really don't understand, you know, what his grand plans were after that. But
mention in the film of them getting a whole bunch of money from running this government in Cuba, and then turning around and pumping that into buying a president of the U.S.
Or even making Michael a president, yes.
I mean, they make direct mention but of I think that buying a U.S. president.
So one of the other interesting things as I watch this movie more and more is to see that Meyer and – not Meyer, I'm sorry – Hyman.
Hyman Roth.
That Roth and Michael are essentially running the same con on each other.
Yeah.
Like when Michael says you got to keep your friends close, but your enemies closer.
Uh-huh.
Roth is running that same con on Michael. You're going to be my successor, Michael. This is going to be all for you. You're going to maybe be the president one day, or you might be the man behind the president. And imagine we're going to make history all the while.
Do they both see it?
That's the thing.
Does Roth see that? Because I know Michael does.
At some point in this, because you know, this kind of leads into the hit on Frank.
Yeah.
Frankie Five Angels. Mm-hmm. You know, where it seems like we're led to believe that this was an attack from the Rosato brothers, architected by Hyman Roth.
I mean, we're not even led to believe it. We're told it.
Who? By who?
Tom says it later on. I can't remember if it's when he's in the den talking with Michael about Roth.
But Michael tells different.
Or if he's talking with Frankie.
But that's the thing. Like, I don't know who to believe. I think that's correct. But Michael tells different versions of the truth to different people as a way to kind of.
That's true.
Keep his cards close to his vest.
He tells Fredo one thing. He tells Frankie another.
Yeah. And you have to kind of just go along with what he's doing. But The plot is it seems like if Hyman did this, he's the fucking Joker from The Dark Knight.
That's the thing.
Like,
that's...
I'm going to kill you, but when I do, I'm going to say Michael Corleone says hello. In case you survive, then I either eliminate my chief rival in New York and leave Michael powerless out there, or I'm going to implicate Michael against his top lieutenant and accomplish the same thing, maybe even greater.
Uh-huh.
Because also, I don't believe that the cop. That wasn't part of the plan. So
no.
He had to have this plan work both ways no matter what. I mean, that's like Batman. That's the Joker.
It is. That strikes me as writers sitting in a room saying, how can we make this plot more intricate?
But then I start thinking, it's like, well, if Hyman Roth is as smart as Michael, it seems like you might be able to, like, look, in the unlikely event that this plan is foiled, I need you to say this is Michael Corleone. It's like, yeah.
That's such a weird, like.
Is it? If you're a 90-year-old gangster who's been through the shit that Meyer Lansky's been through?
That's the thing. Like, I feel like it stretches credibility. Like, my suspension of disbelief is stretched so far at that point. It's like, are these people really that smart and playing all the angles in this way?
Would you think that Vito Corleone would come up with that plan?
I don't know. I mean, there's nothing in Godfather 1 that is that smart.
That diabolical.
Like, purely that smart. Like, I see everyone just playing their cards close to their vest.
Yeah.
And acting like everything is okay. But this is not, this is an active thing that they did. It's not like they're just not showing their cards. They're now showing cards, but showing weird cards, like cards you've never seen
before.
False
flag operation.
What is that? You can't have a boat in a deck of cards. That doesn't make any sense. It's just, I don't know. It stretches credibility for me, and I'm not going to say I don't buy that it could ever happen.
Uh-huh.
It's just one of those things that makes me scratch my head and say, I don't know if this is as good.
See,
as
I think
one.
It's interesting because Godfather 1 is essentially the story of a young punk beating his father's rivals. That his father obviously had beat his whole life because he's the number one guy.
Mm-hmm.
They needed him. He didn't need them. This Godfather 2 is a story of Michael leveling up as a badass and essentially beating his old man. Like, Hyman Roth is on the level of Vito Corleone in terms of power, in terms of cunning, in terms of human intelligence. And I kind of, when I look at it that way, I buy the fact that he's got this. Hmm. You know,
I buy it, but only barely.
Yeah.
Only barely. Like, you've almost lost me at that point.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. I mean, Coppola talks about how much more intricate this film is in its plotting. And I don't know if that harms or helps it, frankly. Like, I love a good, you know, thriller, mystery thriller kind of thing. But that's not what I felt like Godfather 1 was. And that's not what I feel like Godfather 2 needed to be. And this kind of moves into that territory a little bit.
I do think that in this intricate plot, the key statement is when Michael's trying to explain all this to Tom. And it's a great scene. We didn't talk a lot about Tom Hagen in the last, because a lot of this stuff didn't come to fruit until Godfather 2, where Michael sets him and says, you know, Tom, the reason I've kept you out of all the family business is for this very reason. You're like my, in case of emergency, break glass. You're a person I can absolutely trust because you haven't been involved in these dirty dealings. I also think there's a part of that was that he wanted Tom to be his consigliere during the legitimate years of his family, which Michael saw as like, you know, that's the legacy. That's the 40 years I don't want your hands dirty in the 5 years of bloodshed. I want your hands clean so you can work with me into 40 years of us ushering our family into greatness.
Yeah.
Michael had to throw all that away because of, you know, the hit on
the
him.
War, yeah.
But the fact that he had this ultimate trust, I'm going to make you the Don. I'm going to trust you with my family's safety. Mm-hmm. But he made this comment, like, I've always tried to think the way the people around you think. And yeah. That was hugely informative for me when I first saw this. And anytime I'm looking at politics, anytime I'm looking at family squabbles, I've got this almost maddening ability to see the other side of the equation. And I think that's the only way you can make any kind of progress in the world or have any kind of clear view of what's going on. If you just say, like, well, I'm a liberal and conservatives are fucking stupid, or I'm a conservative and liberals are fucking idiots, or, you know, you don't understand the world enough to effect any real change.
Sure.
Or to put yourself into a better situation. And I think that, you know, of course, things don't really work out for Michael. So maybe I'm maybe I'm following the wrong advice here.
Do they? Like, they don't work out in his personal life. Does Michael, in the end, get what he wanted, which is to go legit with the family operations?
I don't know.
I mean, could this be a clean break for him? He's out in Nevada. He's just defeated all of his enemies.
Apparently, there's a sequel that we could find all the answers to. But it seems like he's got much more.
Sure.
No, I don't think he's any closer to being legitimate.
Why not?
There's a huge vacuum of power. Well, I mean, I guess he could just leave New York City.
Yeah. I mean, he's already basically left New York City. Frankie was, as far as I can tell, one of his only ties
back
there.
Once the Senate committee had a hearing and put him on trial, I think that his ability to himself go legit, maybe now his hopes, like his father, are shifting towards maybe his son, which is, I think that's
That'd
the key tension between him and Kate. The fact that she's going to take his children from him. It wasn't just a Sicilian crap. It wasn't just a machismo. It's like, if you take my children away, then I've done all this for nothing. I was a war hero. I was an accomplished, you know, college scholar. I was a man that was on the way to greatness and legitimacy, and I had to come in here and help. I couldn't allow my father be murdered and my family be driven. You know, I couldn't do that. I could have, but my sense of my pride and my honor and my loyalty would not allow me to do that. Mm-hmm. If you take my children from me, then I made all those sacrifices for nothing.
But Michael doesn't see that. Had he been separated from his family and the things that were going on in it, that might have given him the future that his family so desired for him, you know? I mean, that could be the same case with his children now, is that they grow up in the shadow of their father and become just like him, or they're separated from their father and become, like, good-standing citizens, you know? So, like, I feel like this movie has a supremely tragic ending.
Sure.
Michael wins the battle that he's fighting, but he loses so much more in the process.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's the thing. Like, I was talking, I think, with you about this earlier, how this movie is well made. This movie is greatly acted. It looks fantastic and everything. But without the themes in this film, I feel like it's just another gangster movie.
Sure.
Like the themes.
It's the family
of
that makes it.
The family, the father and son dynamic that they've got going on with Vito and Michael. Those are the things that make the Godfather series work, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
At least for me, those are the things that always keep me coming back.
Mm-hmm. But it's weird because some of that, I feel like in the first movie, that case is very strong that, you know, were it not for this a mafia family, this could be an admirable story of starting from nothing and coming, you know, power through a love for family and loyalty and all this stuff. In Godfather Part Two, it's almost more Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah, I'm not like saying that works out for
them. The excess of that success directly leads to their downfall. I mean, yeah, it wasn't Quaaludes and whores and coke. It was murdering your brother and going after an old man beyond all reason and losing so many of your valuable assets, you know.
Yeah, I'm not saying that the family stuff turns out happy. Obviously, it doesn't.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is that those powerful ideas are the thing that really pin this movie up on the wall and say this is great.
We also didn't talk a lot about Fredo in the first movie, other than the fact that he's kind of a joke.
Sure.
Fredo's big in this movie.
Yeah.
Obviously. One thing that bugs me when I'm watching this movie is the call that Johnny makes, who is the Italian spokesman for
Roth,
Roth. He calls Fredo in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
Did we need that scene? I feel like the movie is instantly greater if that scene, and we entirely have to figure this out from the audience, because at a surprisingly early point in the film, this pulls a lot of the drama about whether Fredo was in on it or not. Or if without that move, without that scene, are people just completely lost later with the conversation that they're having at the crazy ass giant dick strip club in Cuba, where Fredo reveals himself?
Maybe. From listening to the commentary, I know that this is a scene where so Coppola is talking about this scene.
Sure.
And he says, "I always advise my film students to shoot their actors talking on the phone, and especially if they can make it to where you can barely see their mouth moving." Because what they did with this scene is, if you look, you can tell. And after he points this out, it's so fucking obvious. You can tell that Fredo is actually saying none of the shit that they're having Fredo say. They went back after the fact and added that dialogue in specifically to make it more clear what's going on. So apparently Coppola thought, yes, we did need this scene to make the movie work, to make this particular part of the plot work.
So they shot it just knowing, like, this is our safety valve in yes. post-production. If we get and it's not making sense, I can insert this somewhere with whatever dialogue I want to patch over
it's
any
smart.
Plot holes.
It's super smart, but that shows that he didn't think it was satisfactory without that scene for whatever reason.
Do you think he has shots of everyone talking on the phone
in
some nondescript location? Like, there's one of Michael, there's one of Tom, and it's like, you know, whatever I need to spackle over the holes in the film, I've got it. That is actually really fucking smart.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all.
What do you think of the guy that plays Fredo, his acting chops?
You know, I can't remember seeing him in much else. What else is he in?
Feast fuck
seen
out of
him
me.
Anything?
I don't know. I'm saying in this particular role. Because I used to think, like,
I don't know if this guy is a great actor, or if he's just like that, you know? Like, that's the thing. I can't really judge his acting ability.
Well,
I guess his performance, like,
because I see him
his
as,
interpretation of Fredo.
I see him as annoying. Like, I buy him when he is the sensitive, thoughtful person. He's the only one that thinks to congratulate Mike on dropping out of college and fighting a war and seeing, like, what a sacrifice that is. He's got this big heart.
Uh-huh.
But he also has this he's also, in my mind, stupid, and he's also ambitious.
He is stupid. I don't think that there's any way to get around that. He gives himself away to Michael and doesn't even realize it.
But so is my annoyance with his character a result of this guy's acting to make me feel that way? So it's like one of those things
that
this character designed to be hateable, and you hate him, and you sympathize with Mike wanting to kill him, and then when he does die, then you start feeling like, oh God, maybe we've all gone too far.
No,
so
I think
selling
that's
that character,
intended.
Selling that character is a tough acting challenge.
Definitely. You don't want him to act like he's as smart as Michael or as tough as Michael. You know, I mean, he's a weak, kind of dim-witted brother of the family.
But he got the one thing he did got from his old man was the people's touch. Like, Fredo's got this glad-handing way about him that just puts people at ease, where Michael feels like a snake slithering through the room. It bites him in his ass because he doesn't have the Don's keen intellect and patience and planning. But he's also like, the other thing is, I feel like that even Tom Hagen, when he's laying this out after the fact, like, Fredo just got taken advantage of. Fredo never intended to betray the family.
Like, Yeah, you're right about that.
And I also feel like that conversation they had in Cuba when he first arrived and Mike said, you know, you got the money, and they're talking about it's not easy to be Vito's son. Mm-hmm. And Fredo says something like, man, I wish we had spent this kind of time together years ago. Implying that Michael has essentially ignored Fredo. He hasn't, you know, the things that Vito said about like spending time with your family is important. You got to do that. You can't be a man if you don't spend time with your family. Those are the lessons that Michael ignored.
Yeah.
And they bit him in the ass in this movie.
Sure. I also think Fredo doesn't quite see his role in the family the way he needs to see it. He wants to be Michael, and he wants to be, you know, the tough guy making the decisions, but there's a need. Michael doesn't have his touch with people, like you said. There's a need for that kind of liaison between families, between business partners. You need the Fredo out there also shaking the hands, kissing the babies a little bit. He doesn't see that role as nearly as important as Michael, and maybe it's not, but what he doesn't understand about it is that Michael's not really distancing him from the family necessarily. He's just got him in a different role. And Fredo just doesn't value that role nearly as much.
Fredo's not smart enough to see that he's in the role. Exactly. And what a good deal. Like, there's a scene that I always sit up and take notice when, you know, Fredo's wife is acting the fool. And he comes over kind of like tail between his legs, and he starts to apologize. Like, you know, she's gets. And Michael says, look, you're my brother. You don't have to apologize. You never have to explain yourself to me.
Uh-huh.
That's a pretty sweet deal to get from your brother.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, Vito would have grabbed you and said, you can act like a man.
And maybe he should have. Like,
maybe.
Open question is, if he had slapped Fredo around a little bit more, would he turn that different, you know?
I don't know.
Had this weird thing where he felt like he could do more, but... And he had a sweet, comfortable existence, but he wanted more. I
just don't feel like he's actually as trivial as he thought he was in that family.
What the hell did he do then?
He made all the arrangements, apparently, with everyone in Vegas. I mean, look what they did. They sent him out there to talk with Mel Green.
Bullshit. He chased skirts. He drank.
I agree. He did all those things. But also, he established relationships out there. I mean,
yeah,
he
walked
up
to Mo Green and said, my brother, the Don of New York, wants to meet with you.
I think it's certainly a lesser role than Michael, but it's not a completely unimportant one.
I feel like he could have been like the family informant. He could have like been the gregarious guy that no one takes serious because he's fucking Fredo.
Uh-huh.
And he can go and he can meet with rival gangs like the lieutenants and stuff and get them drunk and high roll with them and chase skirts and they're gonna loosen up and tell him things, and that'd be that back channel to Michael, but again, he's not smart enough to see his limitations and his strengths. And I don't think Michael maybe appreciated his brother the way he should have as well.
You might be right about that too.
Michael seems like he saw his brothers and sisters as people that need to be protected and watched over and not people that could be trusted and relied on.
Yeah.
And then they acted, you know, like you teach people how to treat you, and they just all taught each other how to treat each other terribly.
Yeah. I mean, by the end of this, Michael's trust is completely eroded in everyone around him. And it's kind of, I won't say heartbreaking, but it is sad, at the very least, to see the way that he questions Tom's loyalty at the end. And I understand his reasons for doing it, but...
That's where you know Michael's gone too far.
Yeah, Tom has never shown you anything but loyalty.
Yeah.
Never showed anything but your father loyalty. Why, at this moment, would he betray you? You don't realize that Fredo was just too stupid to realize that he was betraying you, and that Frankie is not actually part of this family, and so, like, why stop trusting the people in your family?
The thing is there could be... If I watch this movie another 10 times, I might have the answers to all these questions.
Maybe.
It wouldn't surprise me, because there's a lot of things that I just thought were unsolvable, and they were solvable by me watching the movie more.
Sure, I don't think that's... I'm not asking that question to point out a flaw.
Yeah.
What I'm asking that question for is to say, how is Michael's character informed by that, you know?
One thing that I'm almost sure about, but I'm not totally sure, Senator Greery's downfall, where he murders the hooker.
Yeah.
Did the senator murder the hooker, or was he drugged, someone came in and murdered her and then set him up for it? Because it's... The case for that this was a setup was the fact that, you know, he was in a Corleone hotel that happened to be managed by Fredo. So
there's withholding the license and he extorting was Michael.
One of the all-time, like, you want this guy to get it so bad when he's first into it. Because he just, like, nobody talks to, like, even Mo Green didn't talk to that way to Michael. Like, just, it's one thing to be angry, but the condescension and, like, you're nothing. And I am better than you, and I can treat you this way, and there's nothing you can do. And then to see him be brought to heel this way, it's got to be Michael's machinations, right? Or was it just them knowing that the senator would fuck up and letting him hang himself and then being the one that swooped in there with a solution?
I have a definitive answer.
Okay.
From the mouth of the creator himself.
All right.
It was a setup.
Gotcha.
Coppola says something that indicates, yes, Michael planned that, and he did that in order to get the gaming license and all that shit.
Sure, sure. So I was pretty sure that was it. But that was one thing, yeah. I love that shot because they had the shot of the senator sitting at, like, the vanity. And he was looking into the mirror, and the dead girl's face was looking right back into him in the mirror. It was, like, something that I just noticed on this watch. I thought it was really brilliant. Speaking of brilliant scenes, when we go to Cuba and we see that these barons of industry and organized crime are essentially trying to turn this into Tortuga.
Yeah.
The old mythical pirate island. And they're passing a solid gold telephone around, which is the gift of one of the telephone companies. And you see all of the business guys, they're like picking it up and, oh, wow, look how heavy. And, oh, shiny. Ooh, wow, this is such a – Michael just takes it and passes and doesn't even look on it, at it. They take at least 90 seconds to do this all around the table. Hyman Roth is the only other person that just is dismissive. And I felt like that's such a great way to non-verbally show the differences between Michael and these – foppish business leaders, and also the differences and similarities between him and Roth.
For sure. I thought that was great. And actually, Coppola still has that prop, that golden telephone.
Does he?
That he keeps at his winery, along with Michael's desk.
Interesting. Yeah. I would love to sit at Michael's desk.
Yeah, that'd be cool. I like the box that Michael has on his desk, that wooden, like, carving, like this really ornately carved wooden box.
Is that a cigar box, you think?
I assume
his
humidor.
Speaking of brilliant, how about slicing up Cuba?
Oh, that scene is fantastic. Yeah,
the birthday. I think it's his birthday, Hyman Roth's birthday, and it's painted up like Cuba, and he's handing out slices. And it's kind of like the Milton scene from Office Space. Only Michael's, you know, it's like, don't be greedy, Milton. Wait for your turn. Michael gets the last slice, and it's clearly. You can see him, like, his eyes are saying, this is my fucking cake. Why are you people getting pieces of my fucking cake?
That was there definitely as an allusion to what they're doing with Cuba as well, which I think is fantastic. You know, I mean, if you can work those themes into the scenery of your movie, why not?
And he does such many good things with the pacing. Another example is when Fredo, he flies $2 million down to cash to Cuba, and they're sitting in this outdoor cafe, and they're having lunch.
Yeah.
And, you know, he asks him about this assassination, and then the waiter comes up to clear a table. And And it takes, like, you know, 20 seconds to clear this table. All the while, you get the chance to see Fredo's reaction and Michael's reaction.
Yeah, it interrupts that conversation.
But
right
it felt it's like if he without the waiter there coming to interrupt, this would just be a silly scene of these guys eyeballing each other. It'd be like some kind of Spanish soap opera. But that allows the tension to build, and these guys give this awesome performance with their face. Coppola is so fucking good.
And it works because the actors are so good, too. Like, yeah, you can take great material, but if you suck as an actor, it's going to be bad, and vice versa. So, I mean, it's really just everything comes together in these films.
From my question, here's another question. Speaking of unnecessary.
I have tons of stuff still to talk about. This is going to be a long podcast.
No, I'm not even halfway through my notes yet.
Okay,
dude.
Me either.
I'm not trying. So I should stop saying another thing.
We haven't even really talked about Vito's section of this film yet.
No, not really.
Like, just barely.
My opinion, my theory, is that from Cuba on, Fredo is actually true blue for Michael. and would never betray him. And he never meant him any...
I think you're right.
And he never meant him any harm in the first place. Mm-hmm. If Michael... And this is cemented...
But will he fuck up again and just be too stupid to realize that he did it? Is he more of a liability because of how dumb he is?
So do you risk your soul for security? Or do you try to keep your brother close?
Well, we know what Michael does.
Yeah, I know. But I'm saying it's like, you know, it's a what if. Like, if he had... You know, because putting Fredo through the exile clearly changed him.
Definitely.
And I think that he was ready to play his role from that point. But now, for how long? You never
know. Exactly, yeah. And I mean, even if he thinks he's doing things 100% right, he might be too dumb to be trusted.
And he's just too dumb and it's too late to forgive him. But I just wondered.
Man, why do you think Michael loses his family and Vito doesn't? I mean, I know we talked about this a little bit, but specifically... I see Michael as much less loving for his family and more calculating than his father. And that extends even to his family. Like, I think he doesn't, like you said earlier, you know, Vito says you got to spend time with your family or you're not a man. Michael doesn't do that. Michael doesn't spend time with anybody but Tom, really.
I've got a solid theory. Why do you, I want to hear yours first. Why do you think?
I think he views his family more as secondary than Vito did. Like, the business is first, family is second, and I think Vito viewed them as both equal. Equal parts of a whole.
I think what's clear in the birthday scene where he announces that he's rejecting his family, he's going to fight for his country, when he's explaining things to Kay in the wedding sequence in The Godfather, and Michael views his family with contempt.
Like a thing that's dragging him down?
As something's beneath him. Like, I'm a better person than these criminals. I don't want to be this type of person.
He does in Godfather 1, certainly.
And he gets drug into that, like, you know, he gets drug into this system, and then he goes over and he sees how the old... He kind of backs into a love and appreciation where Vito was born into it. Like, you see the concern that he had on, like... You can see how anguished Vito was about Fredo being sick and he having no medicine to give to him.
Yeah.
I never see, like, when you see Michael looking at his son's picture that he drew him, or, you know, compare Michael going down and sitting on his son's bed and said, I'm going away, I'm leaving for business, and his son saying, I can help you. That is essentially the same scene that we saw with Stephen Graham in the latest season of Boardwalk Empire.
Sure.
One really emotionally hit, one kind of didn't. And it's because there's something wrong with Michael, man. I think there's some kind of contempt that he has that is tainted.
Huh.
That he loathes himself somehow for making all these sacrifices at a subconscious level. And it influences the way he treats his family. And ultimately, his family was kind of a bit of a chucklehead. And he had too much contempt and too little humanity to deal with that.
Okay, I could buy that totally.
Do you think would Michael have killed Fredo in Cuba if he came with me, said, "Come with me, you're still my brother"? Would he have killed him?
You mean if shit didn't break bad in Cuba? I'm curious about that.
Regardless,
scene.
If Fredo had come back with Michael instead of trying to go his own way and go into exile, would Michael have killed him? I feel like
I don't know because. When Fredo does come back, Michael doesn't kill him.
Wait until his mother died.
Yeah.
I think that's the key.
Which he promised, Tom? Is Tom the guy he promised? Who did he promise that to?
I don't know. I think it was...
Oh, no. Okay, so Coppola in the commentary track said Mario Puzo made him promise not to kill Fredo until after the mother died.
Yeah.
Because he... Like, Michael would have too much respect for his mother to kill
and that
a family
seems
member
exact.
Before
so
then.
I think Fredo was doomed either way, but Fredo would have been safe coming back until his mom died.
I think so, yeah. For sure.
Okay. Well, what do you got?
I mean, just tons of stuff. I wanted to talk a little bit about our favorite scenes like we did in the first one. That scene where Geary comes in at the beginning and Michael says, you know, I'll make you an offer. My offer is nothing. That's just so good.
The way he says it is nothing. In fact, not only is it nothing, but you're going to pay.
It doesn't
my
really impress
license.
Upon Geary, though. Like, no. He shrugs it off. Like, I'm too powerful for this shit to work on me.
It kind of plays as the opposite of the Undertaker scene from the first, where this guy is, like, on his belly. He's disrespected the Don. He's begging for forgiveness. He knows he shouldn't get into this situation, but he's got to because he wants revenge and justice for his daughter. Geary's the opposite. He's going to Michael with total lack of respect, totally rubbing it into his face, with complete disregard for how much power Michael has, and you just can't wait to see him get fucked.
Sure.
But it's such an enjoyable scene to see Geary just lay on the crazy racial insults, the insults to his family. Yeah.
Hey, Geary kind of gets off easy, honestly. I mean, being blackmailed is certainly better than it could have turned out for him.
Yeah, and honestly, did he flip on Michael during the testimony, or did by recusing himself?
No. Yeah, I think he recused himself, and, you know, he gives this big flowery speech about the Italian people in the process, which I thought was hilarious.
But it also was like, don't let the bad apples influence your view of all Italians. I feel like he was putting Michael in that bad apples column.
Oh, see, I didn't. Like, I think Michael still has everything over his head there. So why is Geary going to flip on him? Do you think he just thinks he's safe now?
But why recuse yourself from the committee when you could be somebody?
Maybe he thinks that this is going to go badly for Michael anyway, and he doesn't want to be a part of that.
That's what I'm thinking, that he's cutting bait and run because he didn't see Michael's ult. So it'd be interesting to see what happens to Geary after this. And I don't know what Michael viewed it. You know, with my knowledge of the movie as it is now, I kind of saw that as a very mild betrayal of Michael. It was kind of like him trying to split the middle down what he needed to do to make his constituents happy back home.
Sure.
And what he needed to do in case, you know, what he could get away with if Michael survives. Right.
Yeah. Maybe you're right. I don't know. I didn't see it that way.
Okay.
So what do you think there is to... I'm going to switch over to Vito a little bit here.
Okay.
For at least a while. What do you think it is about him not speaking, but he sings when he gets to America? Do you think there's any there?
No, I think it was just a very poetic way to cap that scene. A little boy.
Yeah.
You know, you can see this boy is formidable. Like a Jesse Pinkman, a 9-year-old Jesse Pinkman would have curled up into a ball and cried. Vito gets there, pulls up a chair, looks at Statue of Liberty, and sings. This is some kid.
I mean, has he heard, like, of the, you know, the reputation of America, which is, you know, freedom, and everyone's got a shot here, and is this something that he's, like, happy to be in America, and so he's singing?
I don't know, because he's 9 years old.
Does he understand any of that stuff?
Yeah, like, my son's an idiot.
And then
he doesn't know the rest of the world. He thinks the world is the United States and Egypt.
That's the thing.
Anytime, like, he says something about, like, foreign country, it's always Egypt.
Why Egypt?
Beats the shit out of me because it's got pyramids, and we're always talking about the Middle East. And also his Bible stuff. It's always Egypt. Stuff happened in Egypt. But that's how he sees the world. Like, if I could ask him, what's the fundamental difference between North Korea and the United States? He wouldn't even know what the fuck North Korea is. Maybe he'd know Russia, but yeah.
Huh, okay. So you don't think Vito has any idea?
No, I just think it's like this is a kid that has very little fear, and his not talking is more of him listening and paying attention.
Okay.
And even late in life, you see Vito, he's a man of few words.
Yeah. Yeah, and I like Robert De Niro's performance of Vito. It's just subtle enough to where, because, I mean, I've seen, you know, Robert De Niro's later works,
just
and
like
Robert
Al Pacino.
De Niro can get over the top and ridiculous.
Robert De Niro is stuck playing, you know, I feel like, you know, the 1-2 punch of Goodfellas and Casino ruined Robert De Niro in the same way that, like, Mad Dog and Glory and Scent of a Woman ruined Al Pacino.
Sure, I can buy that. But in this film, he does such a great job of subtly acting like a younger Vito, so much so that I can hardly tell it's Robert De Niro. He really does transform himself, I think, into more
that
of a
scene
Vito.
Where the apartment manager comes and, like, reverse negotiates that old woman's mortgage.
Oh, yes.
That's brilliant, the way he channels the Brando mannerisms, and he says like 6 words in the whole damn thing.
That scene, So another commentary thing here. Coppola said, and you can tell if you watch this scene, it's so fucking obvious and it's hilarious. The guy, the apartment manager, comes up to the door and he can't get in. He can't open the door. And then when he goes to get out, he can't open the door and he fumbles around.
Sure.
So that was actually a nail that they had that they put in that door that kept it from opening.
And they didn't tell the guy?
And they didn't tell the guy. So if you watch it, you could see the kid who opens the door for him goes up, pulls the nail out, opens the door, and then when he's got his back to him, he puts the nail back in and goes to stand on his mark.
Gotcha.
And the entire time, you can see the kid, like, kind of smiling, like laughing, like he knows what's about to come up. And then when Robert De Niro and him are laughing and chuckling back and forth, it's because they know that that nail is there.
But it's
also funny on the face of it. Like,
sure,
this guy just fumbling around with this door, and he's so awkward and so worried about
who
he's talking to.
Because Coppola's just sitting there and saying, well, he's not saying cut, so I guess I'll continue.
Yes. Yeah, it's brilliant.
Yeah, you know, the one kind of downer that I got from the Coppola commentary is that, you know, you do get the flavor of, like, he's kind of he doesn't like this film as much.
A little bit.
And also, it feels like the first one was such a fucking struggle, and this one was so clockwork that I feel like he liked the fight. He liked the struggle.
And but he definitely doesn't say that.
But don't you get that opinion? That, like, this thing just wasn't as, you know, everything ran smooth. He got his way. He had a lot of power because The Godfather was such a hit that it felt like that it wasn't as much fun making it. And there weren't nearly as many cool details and stories like that as there were from the first Godfather.
Yeah, I don't know where the division between fun and success needs to be drawn here, where that line needs to go. Because I don't know. Artists, I've heard it said that artists sometimes do their best work when they're constrained, and that given an infinite blank canvas, they don't produce work on the same caliber. But I certainly felt like Coppola himself would tell you I had a much better time making Godfather 2. Whether that contributed to Godfather 1 potentially being better or worse than Godfather 2, I couldn't tell you.
So you think the opposite impression.
Based on what he says, he certainly enjoyed the process more, and I just don't know. I just can't tell. So
interesting. Okay.
Sorry for the non-answer, but it really is, like, in my head, I'm not sure.
That's weird because, you know, I read a bunch of interviews and behind-the-scenes stuff, and then I listened to his comment. Whereas The Godfather, I listened to commentary first and then did the research. Okay. I wonder if I'm a little bit influenced by – and I wonder if that's this – him turning against The Godfather 2 and all the sequels. The interview I saw, or again, was referenced 2008. I don't know when he recorded his commentary.
I don't know either.
The Coppola restoration, I think, came out in, like, 2008. So that was contemporary of him coming and saying, man, I wish I hadn't made any sequels. I'm very surprised that it came across that, yeah, this was a super enjoyable experience. But again, maybe that is. Like, didn't feel like he suffered enough.
Yeah, potentially.
Speaking of favorite scenes, love everything about Vito taking down Don Fanucci.
Yeah.
That long tracking shot of him through the festival. Along the rooftops, him lying in wait. Everything that Don's doing... where he just, you know, he's looking at this puppet show. He's like, oh, this is too violent for me. And the way he's, you know, stapling $100 bills to the Jesus cross. And
he just seems
like a fucking idiot.
Yeah, what an insult to take the $100 that those guys just gave you and staple it to that.
Yeah.
That mannequin.
And then when he gets taken down, we see the reverse where, you know, Vito goes back through the festival the wrong way, and he puts, you know, he puts the gun in all the different chimneys. Great way to end the first half of the movie, going into the intermission.
For sure. I know we've talked a little bit about Clemenza.
By the way, it should be a fucking federal law that if your movie's 3 hours long, you have an intermission. Fuck you,
Titanic,
Peter Jackson with your Hobbit movies with no intermission.
Yeah, yeah.
We need an intermission on these. First, we don't need three-hour-long Hobbit movies.
No, nowhere near
it. But if you're going to do it, you need a goddamn intermission.
Okay. I'll lobby for that when I get in power.
Please.
The other thing, so we've talked a little bit about, you know, whether or not Vito ever gets in a life of crime if Clemenza is not there. But he does, and he takes him in this house, and he goes to get the rug. I absolutely love this scene.
Oh, it's
I mean,
so great.
There's the comedy of it, certainly, when, you know, he's like, oh, well, my friend, he's got a rug. Oh, yeah. He's not home. Oh, I must have left it. Oh, he forgot to leave me my key.
Yeah, can you
That's
believe
okay.
this?
That's okay. He won't mind, and he breaks in. Robert De Niro all the time is looking around his shoulders. What? Is somebody going to see this?
Like, he's not stupid. He knows this is wrong, but he also is going to go along with it.
But then once they get inside, that scene where the cop comes to the door, the way that that is shot is incredible.
It goes from comedy to this
incredible.
Tense.
It's so tense and it's so dark because you know exactly what's going to happen if that guy opens that door.
It's a gorgeous shot. And
it's beautiful, yeah.
I love the fact on the Blu-rays that all of the menus are animated and they're all like these stills. Like one of them is Vito sitting in a chair singing to the Statue of Liberty. Just the only thing moving is his feet kicking. There's also the Clemenza scene where he's up against the wall motionless with this cop peering in.
Yeah.
And the first one, it was the scene of the who was
Michael standing in the window?
Well, there's one of them, but also was of the boathouse. Yeah. But in the first one, there's one of the transition scenes was Polly leaned slumped over the car, murdered in that sea of weeds, off on the off ramp. There's so many, but there's so many almost paintings in these movies, and that's one of the greatest ones that you just almost gasp when you see it for the first time.
Yeah. No, I believe he calls it a tableau in that scene, and I just love it. I think it's great.
Another thing, like, speaking of taking your time, like when we come back from intermission, we spend ages just going with Michael through his house looking for Kay. And
we needed
that to feel the isolation and to feel the distance that's crept up between it. The other thing, great thing about this movie is you can see the moment that their marriage ended. Like we talked about the scene in the end of the first Godfather when she looks in and sees him becoming the Don. That's the start.
Mm-hmm.
But the moment their marriage ends is when they're all huddled in his basement after the attack and she has her arms around her children and she shoots him a dagger glare. And what's funny is that the marriage ends twice. The first time is I think it ended there. The second time is when Michael tried to comfort her about the miscarriage. And then he became aware of the abortion. That's when both parties became aware of it. But I just love the fact that you can see, because even at the party, she's chiding him about, you said 5 years, it's been seven.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm trying, darling, I'm trying. And you can tell that she's still very much in love with him.
Yeah.
But that violence brought to their bedroom by his lifestyle was it. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's another fantastic fucking scene where he finds out about the abortion.
Can we talk about the oranges meaning death? Like Godfather is largely credited for starting that with, the Don being gunned down. There's oranges from hell to breakfast in this movie, and they're totally unassociated with death.
Completely, yeah. And Coppola addresses this point in the commentary as well. And he says basically the orange is a symbol of Sicily, both the good and the bad parts. And at some point, like along the lines, they had heard about this theory and stuff. And they dismissed that, but they said there's something about the orange that is foreboding, that is representative of the old world and the new world and tying them together. And that's why they use it so much, but it doesn't have any meaning beyond that.
And it pops in a movie that's so dark.
Exactly. Yeah.
Every time you see his oranges, you kind of take notice, so your eye is drawn to them.
Yeah. So, I mean, even Coppola himself has discredited that.
Mm.
So stop saying it, people.
Okay. What else we need to talk about?
I'm wondering, like, what if Vito had a similar revelation to what Michael gets with Kate telling him about the abortion? How do you think Vito reacts to that as opposed to Michael? Because Michael threatens her. Michael essentially says, I'm going to kill you if you try and take my kids.
Yeah. I don't think he threatens her. He just says it's in, what you're asking is an impossibility.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, sure, but to her, that's got to mean like sure. I will use and all my means.
And then when later, when
killing is one of them,
when that scene where Connie is trying to get her out of the house before Michael gets back because she's had some kind of prearranged visit.
So tense.
That feels like a bomb is going to go off. And then when Michael gets there and just like backs her out of his house with the force of his personality, shuts the door right in her face in front of his children. Holy shit, that's cold.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
But I don't know because like you're asking me, like, you know, a lot of times on Ask Science subreddit where you have scientists answering questions, every once in a while people will come in and be like, if the sun just disappeared, what would the planets do? And the scientist also like, you're asking us to speculate on something that is not like impossible by our current technical standards. It's literally impossible. You can't make that much mass, any mass, disappear, let alone the mass of the sun. Like,
so you think that Vito would just never be in a situation where his family would turn on him? That's the thing.
Like, you're asking me to imagine a situation where his wife drops, like I cheated on you, Vito. Fredo and Michael aren't even your son. That's Clemenza's sons. I can't fucking conceive.
I knew about Fredo, but... But Michael, my only kid.
Right. Fredo, I knew he was a gypsy baby. I'll give you that one. But Michael, like, I can't conceive of...
Yeah, you're right.
That
you're right.
Happening because their relationship is so strong.
Yeah, it's fundamentally different.
And the way they view family, like remember the scene where Michael's talking to his mother, where he's pretty much a remorseful, pitiless bastard in his whole. And you're not asked to feel sympathy for Michael through much of the movie.
Which time is this?
But this scene is where he's at. He's right after intermission. He's going to say, "Mom, I want to know what was in Father's heart."
Okay, gotcha.
Like when he's protecting the family, he's being strong. Did he ever worry about losing us? And you could see the confusion on her face. Like, what? You can't lose your family.
Yeah,
that's why I say it's like I can't even.
That's
imagine.
Crushing, man. Because Michael knows he is. Like, you go to your mom and you say, "Why am I losing my family?" She's like, "You can't lose your family." She can't even conceive of a scenario under which the family would turn on you. But Michael has created that scenario.
And he blames it on the times, which I think there's a little bit to that.
I mean, maybe with Connie, that's brought out a little bit. Yeah. You know, she goes a little off the deep end.
She's a wild child.
Yeah.
And the drugs and everything's like, sure. You know, Vito is making this thing an honorable, respectable, as much as you can make running rackets and extortion and murder.
Right.
But this, part of this is the prophecy of the dawn coming true, right?
Part of it is, yeah. Like with the we drugs are kind of just turning everything
by pursuing money at all costs. It's just like capitalism too, right? Anytime you start pursuing money at the cost of everything else, things go bad.
Yeah, definitely. So why don't you think, I mean, there's obviously a theme of Michael losing his family, and I think that's super obvious in this film. Michael in the end doesn't lose his kids. Why do you think that Coppola, Puzo, and everyone decided not to take those from Michael?
How do you know he didn't lose them? I suspect he did. I feel like, do you feel like Kate is perceptive when she's given her speech about, you know, there's something wrong with Anthony. You don't see it because you don't spend enough time with him, but he's, you know, I feel like
there's a great scene. But before I forget to talk about this, that scene where Michael and Kate are arguing in their house or in an apartment somewhere or something.
And the kids are out in the hall.
And you can see the contrast between what the son knows is going on because he's old enough and he understands and what the daughter is doing. She's just running around playing.
Yeah.
That's
later
brutal.
On his mom saying, you know, Anthony, give your mother a hug and a kiss. He's like 9 years old. That should be an automatic action for a child, and he's not, because he's becoming his father's son. But
that's why I say that she didn't get the kids, because they don't leave with her at the end. But
you don't, I mean, that's what I'm saying.
You might be right. Maybe he does lose them,
right?
Just not at that exact moment.
Right. I'm sure there's people that've seen Godfather 3 screaming at it right now. Yeah. But without Godfather 3, my intuition was that Michael has lost everything, because he had finally gotten Connie on his side. And she was starting to take care of him the way an Italian mother would. And but now that he's killed Fredo, that's going to go away.
Oh, yeah.
He's lost his wife. His son is turning into someone like him, which if he follows that trajectory, he's going to reject his father. And he's not going to go along with his plans for him. So, like, I feel like he's sowed the seeds of his own demise and lost his soul in the process. That last scene of him just looking out over Lake Tahoe.
Yeah.
Brutal.
That's a crushing scene. And it's you know, it's the combination of that scene and the scene right before it with his family before this whole thing started. Kind of right before Michael, right after Michael came back from the military, before Godfather 1. That scene is so brilliantly constructed because it shows, it starts out with, I think, Michael and Tom, like the brothers.
Did you say World War One?
No, sorry, World War
II. Okay, I just want to make sure.
World War II. So it starts out with the brothers at the table, I think. I don't think it's just Michael at the table, but it starts out with the three brothers at the table, Tom, Sonny, and Michael.
And Fredo. He's there too.
Fredo walks in. That's why I'm not sure. Like,
does he? Because I thought he was there and Tessio walks in with the cake.
So a bunch of people walk in.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
A bunch of people walk in and out, and I think Fredo was one that walked in. I'm not certain. But
he's definitely sitting there when Michael drops the bomb that he's going to fight for his country.
Yes, for sure. But at the end of that scene, which is the more important part, one by one, you see his family walk out on him.
Sure.
And by the end of that scene, everyone has left that table except Michael, who is left to just contemplate his actions and his future. And then you can see that transform into Michael contemplating how all of that got so fucked up.
Yeah, he was trying to run away from
all this.
That's
why it's such a poignant moment.
And also the fact that, again, Fredo was the only one to try to look at it from his point of view.
Uh-huh.
And see the thing that he was trying to do and just be happy for him. Like, congratulations, Mike. Now, that you could say that's because Fredo's an idiot. But also, I think if we're trying to see that this is Michael meditating over his past, that's got to eat at him.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, there is nothing about killing Fredo that Michael actually wanted to do, I think. It's just circumstances brought him to that. What do you think Tom Hagen's doing at the end of this film?
I don't.
Because he's not shown again after he talks with Frankie.
I don't know what Tom does because
I feel like he might have abandoned Michael too, but I don't know why, and I don't know
how you abandon Michael in that position without you know, getting out alive. I don't know, because clearly Michael's hurt him, and it's like you go from how much love and respect they had for each other, and you can see how Tom has been wounded by Michael, like, rejecting him. Because he's like, you know, Mike, if you need anything, I'm right out here. And then when Michael sits in that and explains the situation, you see how much kind of love and mutual respect is there. But by the end of the movie, that's gone.
Yeah, no, he's paranoid, and he's considering the fact that Tom might be against him.
And Tom's saying, like, do you have to kill everyone? Like, why are you got this hard-on for Hyman Roth? Which is
a very nice parallel structure
between Vito's need for revenge against this old Don. Was it Andolini? No, that was his name before he was Corleone. But this old mobster to kill this father, he's on death's door. His eyes are rheumy. He might be a little senile. He's hard of hearing. If he waits 3 months, the guy's going to die.
Yeah.
But he needed to send him out on his terms. And Michael's same need is, you know, I don't know what he lost. I mean, obviously he lost Rocco, one of his top men in the assassination attempt. Mm. You got to wonder, like, how that will come back on him politically. But I just, you know, Hyman Roth, it would have been, I think the other thing is short-sighted, is that it would have been a worse fate for him to have to continually. He's basically Tom Hanks in The Terminal. He's a man without a country.
Okay, sure.
That he's going to live out his life in indignity and with no home, no respect, no fortunes. You kill him in a blaze of glory. I think Hyman would prefer that. I just don't get Michael's need for revenge. His father had the same one that didn't make any rational sense, yet they turned out so differently. But we've already talked about all that.
No,
too,
we have. I don't know. I'm struggling to think of anything else that just screams talk about me.
How about the scene of Michael approaching Fredo, where it's a tracking shot like in a U shape, where you follow Michael going through the crowd and everyone's reactions, so he finally approaches Fredo.
Oh, with the New Year's celebration?
No, when his mother's dead at the death of his funeral.
I don't remember that.
So he's at his mom's funeral, and Fredo's asked to talk to him, and Fredo's sitting in a chair, and he's broken down. Michael, his sister comes and treats on Fredo's behalf. Michael comes out, walks around, and then grabs Fredo's head, and Fredo hugs him at his waist.
Hmm.
And I felt like that approach gave it this really epic weight, but then you see Michael lock eyes with Al Neary. And I'm like, damn.
Boat scene.
So there's a question.
Yeah.
Vito had Luca Brasi. Michael, in the book, they make it very explicit that Al Neary was his Luca Brasi, one that was unquestionably loyal.
Sure.
But they're two different. Like, Luca Brasi was power and muscle, very little brain. Al Neary seemed like the opposite. He was much more cunning and he had a lot more smarts going on to him.
Mm-hmm.
Which would you take? Would you take Luca Brasi or would you take Al Neary if you needed an enforcer?
Well, I think I might take Al Neary. I don't know. I don't know which one I take. I know why Michael takes the one he does.
Well, because Luca Brasi's dead.
Granted. Granted, but why he doesn't just go for another Luca Brasi, why he kind of switches it up. I feel like Michael is a more calculating person himself.
Than Vito?
In some ways, yeah. Huh. I mean, look at the fucking plot of this film, man.
Sure, sure.
It's definitely more dense than the other one. And I feel like that's reflected in the people he chooses to have around him. So maybe that's why he's got Al Neary instead of a Luca Brasi equivalent. But it was also super confusing to me that during his time in Cuba, he's got some dude in a black hat. Like, who the fuck is this enforcer guy?
Frankenstein.
And why doesn't he have Al Neary with him? And we talked a little bit about this, but I want to get it on the podcast.
Yeah. So, like, because that was a question I had, too. Is like, if you're going down there and you needed to make sure this assassination goes off without a hit, what do you take this second-run Frankenstein over Al Neary? And I realized that from Michael's standpoint,
take Ernest Borgnine down there,
skinny, more Frankenstein like Ernest Borgnine. if I'm Michael, protecting my family is the most important thing. I want Al Neary and Tom Hagen guarding my family, and I'll take the B team down for the assassination. They're still pretty good, but I want fucking Al Neary around my family to making sure nothing bad goes down,
especially right after that attempt on their lives.
Yeah.
Makes a lot of sense. I'm satisfied with that.
What about Tom? So here's the thing that is maybe a little shed of light about what goes on with Tom.
Okay.
The scene where he goes and talks to Frankie happens
great scene, but
it happens after he has the fallout with Michael.
Yeah.
But Tom is carrying Michael's weight like he is a 5-gallon bucket. He's carrying his water like it's a 5-gallon bucket. That to me says that Tom forgives him for everything and he's still Michael's man.
Tom forgives Frank?
No, Michael. I don't think Tom's mad at Frank, and I don't think Frank's mad at Michael. I feel like everybody understands what needs to happen now.
Sure.
Like, this was all
Frank himself, yeah.
This was all a misunderstanding, but you're never getting out of jail. You don't even want this deal. Michael can't allow this to go unpunished.
Yeah, they make a good point of Frankie saying, "Hey, I got my own family back." Like a long time ago in this film.
Yeah.
And that all comes back around to him saying, just keep my family safe, care for them, and I will take myself out. Because that's where this is going anyway. I'm just going to secure a final ending for my family.
But it's funny because I was almost like Tom had more of his, like Tom got all of Vito's warmth.
Yeah.
And Michael got, but then again, Tom has a mistress. Do you think I don't ever think Vito had a mistress. Like, if he was going to, he's going to do it as a young man, and he was, like, saying to even his buddies when they're on a night at the town, like, I got my wife and kids, and that's all for me.
Yeah, I think you're right.
He's probably the only fucking godfather in history, real or fictional, that hasn't had mistresses on the side, but I don't think Vito had mistresses.
No, I think you're right.
And you look at Mrs. Godfather, and like, why would you have a mistress? That is a hell of a woman.
Sure. Yeah, it was funny, because Coppola is talking about her in the commentary, and he's like, I was looking for a woman who was beautiful, and yet could go in the kitchen and cook up a pasta sauce. Because that's what Italian women were at the time, you know? So I think they found one in her.
She's
looks
awesome.
A lot like that. Yeah.
She's fucking great character with so does so much with so little.
Yeah. Yeah. Do we want to talk about the final thing, which is how these two movies compare with each other? Godfather 1 and Godfather 2. Or do you have more to talk about?
We already talked about Pentangelo and did he work better than Clemenza? Mm-hmm. Like if they brought...
Yep.
Imagine if they got the Clemenza guy to come back and he did everything that Frankie had to do. I almost feel like it worked better because there was that... That scene where he goes back to Vito's old home and Frankie's there and he has that speech about, I'm glad this never went to strangers. First, when it somehow the fact that Clemenza, there was a death and a transition, somehow made it a little bit more poignant. And I don't know that that guy, as great as he was,
yeah,
I don't know that this would have worked as well. Like, I mean, I can see him, like, I can see Clemenza doing the courtroom scene. And like, you know, and I can see him being the kind of like the drunk guy at the party. But
yeah,
the scene of him and Tom Hagen coming up with that understanding in the prison run behind all the fencing. I don't know that he does as good a job at that. The scene where Mike comes to him and says, I need your help to get revenge on my enemies. I don't know that he carries that as well.
Yeah. The trouble is now that I've seen so much of Frankie. And I've seen so little of Clemenza. Like, he doesn't do a ton in the first movie.
But Clemenza had the scene in the basement where he was...
With the gun, yeah.
Then that was really good,
Michael
too.
That was fantastic, yeah. But it was kind of just a short little scene. And I don't know how he would do in a longer form thing. I've never seen him in any other films either. But I feel like I'm totally satisfied with Frankie. Whether Clemenza would have been better or not, I am satisfied with Frankie. And I think... That courtroom scene is one of the scenes that really just makes me say, yeah, Frankie's a great character.
Frankie, like, Five Angels.
That's another scene I wanted to talk about
a
little bit.
Sure.
Michael brings Frankie's brother in from Sicily. And he just walks him into the courtroom.
Yep.
As Frankie's about to testify against him. And Frankie totally changes his mind on seeing that. Why do you think he changes his mind? And what do you think Michael's actual goals were with bringing him in there? Aside from, like, why do you think Michael thought this would work?
Well, it's weird because I'm the older brother. I'm not the younger brother. So I don't know how that relationship works.
I'm too, yeah.
But the way I think we're supposed to understand is this is Frankie's older brother who's still – he's from the old country. And he is old-time Sicilian mafia. Mm-hmm. And bringing him into that courtroom and having him look like, what the fuck are you doing? You're my blood, and you're about to testify against your Don in front of this federal... What the fuck? Just him being there staring at... Now, I think the guy that they had to play him...
Yeah, yeah. He's a little dopey.
He's dopey, and it doesn't help that he's dressed in that weird-ass Sicilian...
All right, yeah.
Like you know, we talked about, like, the Sicilian gangsters look like they're just out having a duck hunt.
He looks like a Mr. Magoo type of character to me.
They
like
needed somebody... They needed a Clemenza not wearing...
Somebody who's got a little
lederhosen
weight
and
to
stuff.
His presence.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Yeah. But,
not literal weight.
Yeah, yeah. But and the way he acted was almost like... The first time I saw the movie, I thought that it was implied that he was going to kill his brother.
That's the thing. I'm wondering if Michael isn't doing this for a couple of reasons.
I don't buy it. Not after what Tom says and Michael say about the guy. And
I know Tom makes it come across, but like,
and Frankie himself said, "That's my old brother. He's old school. If he come to America, he'd have his own family. You know, he'd be one of the leaders of the five families."
I'm just not sure because the shit going through Michael's head in this movie is bad news.
I mean,
Tom is against him. He thinks Frankie's against him. Fredo's against him. Like, he thinks everyone is against him. And I could see, like, Tom not being in on the loop that Michael might have killed this guy.
I don't think...
And this was a threat.
Trust me. I don't think Michael would not kill the man if he thought it was to his advantage. I just don't think that that's what really was going on. I think Michael thought... That if he brought his brother here to give
it's
a reminder,
to shame him, not to threaten him.
Yeah, I was like, "This is you're not even a, like if you go through this, you're not even a man anymore."
Yeah,
and that means a lot to these guys.
Yeah, I mean, it might have even just been a reminder: hey, you have a family, and if you do this,
well,
they're not going to be killed, but they're not going to be taken care of.
Right. I guess it
and
does.
So
set
Tom
up
going
that.
To him after that and saying, "This is what we want to do. We'll take care of your family." that might be supported. I don't know. I didn't think of that before, but just now it's hitting me.
So we've teased people long enough.
Yep.
Is The Godfather 2 The Empire Strikes Back? Is it The Return of the Jedi? Is it The Phantom Menace?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? After, was this like your third time seeing this movie?
Yeah, something like that.
You've seen it four times total now? Because you watched it twice.
Yeah, I watched the commentary. Although the commentary, I was just mostly listening.
Sure.
And then when he said something super interesting about a scene, I'd look up and see what was going on. I've seen it a few times now. This is the only time that I've really sat down and watched it. And I would say it is not quite as good as Godfather 1.
Hmm.
I think the first Godfather, it's such just a neat, well-told story.
Did not need a sequel.
Didn't need a sequel. And that's the thing. Like, Coppola had no intention of making a sequel, and Paramount came to him, and they were so hot to do it because of how successful Godfather, the original, was. That he finally basically
Coppola's like whoa, you're saying that Paramount's going to guarantee our return? he went
pretty
sunny
much,
on it.
Yeah, no, they guaranteed that they would not get in his way, for sure.
And you can tell.
Yeah.
He made a 3.5-hour, probably wildly expensive, with the...
I imagine so.
Double cast, mm-hmm. Quadruple locations.
Bringing back people who were already super famous. I mean, Robert De Niro at the time was a... really controversial choice because he was famous as a contemporary actor.
So he had Taxi Driver, he had
Raging Bull.
He was,
even as Coppola says, very famous at the time. And the studio said, no way are we letting you do Robert De Niro. And of course, Robert De Niro's in the film at the end.
It was weird. I got it from the commentaries that Coppola wanted Martin Scorsese to direct this.
Oh, maybe
that's
so.
That's the one battle I guess he lost.
Hmm.
The studio's like, no fucking way, we want you to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
And obviously, so when I heard that, and he never really got back to it, I'm like, well, shit, maybe Martin Scorsese did direct this. This is like, wasn't it Lawrence Kasdan that directed Empire Strikes Back? But unless you're a real movie nerd or Star Wars nerd, you don't know that. You assume George Lucas directed it all?
Sure, yeah. George Lucas directed the first one. That's it.
Yeah, and all of the prequels.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
You count those as Star Wars movies?
Yeah.
So, I don't know, because I feel like it didn't need to be made.
Irvin Kershner, what the fuck? My producer and director confused.
The movie didn't need to be made, but once it was made, I thought it was great, of course. And also...
So is it Return of the Jedi to A New Hope? Would you say that it's...
If New Hope were better, if New Hope was Empire Strikes Back
Okay.
level of quality... And is you it, increase so, the quality of Return of the Jedi appropriately.
Okay, so is it
yes.
is this the new hope to
oh my God.
The Godfather's Empire?
We need to go to another franchise to make this comparison.
Oh, fuck off. Seriously, is this like a new hope quality compared to Godfather's Empire Strikes Back?
Easily, yeah.
Okay, even maybe a little bit better.
Yeah.
Like there
is
no real analog.
Yeah.
I'm tempted to say that they're equal. And I thought that that's what I was going to come away with, because I can't say that it's better.
Yeah.
It's darker. It's more complex. It's more ambitious.
Oh, yeah.
It's not as entertaining in a way. Like Godfather's complex, but it's effortless. You just keep watching it and you'll get it.
Yeah.
The Godfather 2 is not that way. You have to work at it, watch it multiple times before you know confidently what the hell's going on. Even then, there's like some things I know, and there's a lot of things I think I know. And I need to watch it a couple more times. But mm-hmm. I fucked up again, and I watched Godfather 2 back-to-back, and I keep coming back to Godfather in some way that I can't quite put my finger on it. The watchability, mm-hmm. the fact that it's the first, it's the groundbreaking thing, it feels better. Not like Heads and Shoulders.
Yeah, yeah, I'm with you.
But like... You know, if someone's not seen The Godfather, I'd be offended, and I'd probably hound them as a friend until they watch it. I don't really care. I think they should watch The Godfather 2, but I wouldn't be scandalized if they didn't see it.
Hmm.
You know, if someone says they saw The Godfather, the one thing I was blown away is how many people are indifferent to The Godfather. A lot of our fans were like, you know, people's whose I know who are intelligent and whose opinions I value are like, meh, it was boring. Or Brando is a scenery chewer. And I just, I'm not going to call you a fool because I know that's not the case. But man,
scenery chewer.
And I know it's all subjective, but Jesus Christ, I can't put myself in that mindset. Like, I can even see where they're going because he's packing his cheeks full of cotton.
But he speaks so little. I mean, the whole philosophy of knowing when to speak and when to listen is a Vito Corleone thing. It's like that is him during the movies. He doesn't swing from the chandeliers. He's not screaming at people like Al Pacino is at Kate.
But even then, that only works because Pacino is so reserved through everything.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
In this movie, same way. Like, the abortion scene works because he is so restrained.
Yes.
When he goes to Frankie and he's like, did you hear about what happened in my house? In my house!
Yeah, where my children sleep.
Where my wife sleeps and my children play with their toys. It's just, it works because he is so willing to rein it in throughout the rest of the movie.
But that's what I mean. Like, to me, getting extremely animated and extremely loud and stuff, that's scenery chewing. What Marlon Brando is doing in the first one is such a level, even performance from that guy. Despite transforming himself into a kind of quirky character, it's not scenery chewing.
Is he chewing the scenery when Michael comes to him and tells him, I'm with you, Pop, in the hospital, and he just has tears brimming in his eyes? Is he chewing the scenery when he finds Tom Hagen in his house and says, What am I the last person in this house to know? You know, you've had your drink.
Yeah.
You know, tell your Don what's troubling you.
I can't.
There's
see
so many
it.
Things, and like, is he chewing the scenery in the meeting with the five families? No,
no, he's a level-headed, even character.
He's weaving a fucking spell, in my opinion.
Yeah, me too. And you know, the naysayers are not here to defend themselves, so I don't want to get on them too much.
Right.
But from my perspective, I don't see him chewing scenery. And if anything, I could see the slight occasions where Al Pacino gets his outburst as scenery chewing, if you want to call it that. But it works.
It's appropriate. The scenery is there to be devoured.
Sure, that's also true. But it works, like you said, because he's so reserved in other times, and it punctuates his performance in a way that doesn't feel like scenery chewing to me.
He's not chewing scenery, he's chewing the buffet. There's a Las Vegas-style buffet set in the scene with all these great actors.
It's like going to Willy Wonka's factory. You can't blame me for chewing the scenery.
Yeah.
You've designed it to be delicious.
Yes.
But I feel like the later Al Pacino, the version of Al Pacino that Al Pacino has become, is a scenery chewer, whereas this version is not.
Now, he's a parody of himself.
Yeah.
Like, it's sad. It's sad to see guys like, and Harrison Ford is another one. Like, you see him in goddamn Ender's Game, and he's so terrible. And he's been terrible in so many things for so long.
You know what I liked him in? 42. Like, that Jackie Robinson?
I hadn't seen that one.
Film? Man, that's good.
But it's like, and every once in a while they'll get material that engages them and challenges them. But, like, they just are content to coast. And it's sad to see. And it seems like all the great actors kind of do that. I'm trying to think of one that, like, Daniel Day-Lewis maybe is a guy that's still, and maybe he's just not old enough, but there's a guy that rolls up his sleeves, clocks in, and works at every fucking movie.
Fucking Paul Newman and Robert Redford. Like,
okay.
Those guys, holy shit. They stay true to being great actors for their entire lives. I mean, Robert Redford's life is not over yet. Paul Newman's is, and he was fantastic till the day he died.
Sure.
His catalog just blows me away. But yeah, I don't know. I don't like this as much as Godfather 1. And it's because of some of the plot contrivances, like I said, with, you know.
It's not as much fun.
Frankie trying to be killed and Michael Corleone says hello.
It's a much more intellectual, cerebral experience where the Godfather's got more heart. And it's a more.
Yeah, and that's reflective of the characters that it's about, right?
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, this one's. That's the interesting thing is Coppola says he didn't – when they came to him and said, let's do Godfather 2, you know, he resisted it. But he had this idea for a film, not The Godfather. He was making something else where you have these crossing arcs. Of father and son, one – both one rising to power, one falling out of power, Or, you know, Michael doesn't fall out of power, but he loses a lot in the process.
He definitely loses.
And that
himself.
Was converted to a Godfather film.
Sure.
Somewhere along the way.
Retrofitted. So, that makes sense.
And then he said he wanted to do one where it's like a good man becoming bad and a bad man becoming good and those kind of crossing. I don't know if he ever did that after that commentary, but
I don't know. Like I said, I can't
find out.
I'm really, really looking forward to seeing Godfather 3 now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although
we'll
in a weird way that like I'm full expecting to be kicked in the nuts. Because it's like as universal as the opinion that I kind of disagree with, I guess, that Godfather 2 is better than The Godfather.
Mm-hmm.
It's that kind of universal opinion that The Godfather 3 is just a travesty.
Yeah.
It seems hard to believe that Coppola would do something like that, would make something that wrongheaded and bullshitty.
Yeah. Well, we'll find out eventually. I think we're going to, our plan is to watch 3 at some point and do a podcast about it.
Yeah.
But I don't know when. Yeah. We'll wait for the 40th anniversary. So 2030.
No, see, I want to watch the first and do an instant take because, again, I don't know. You don't get a chance to see a movie like that for the first time and get someone's instant reaction to it.
Yeah.
And then, like, yeah, if we want to do next Christmas a kind of this version of the podcast where we, like, really go into it,
mm-hmm.
I would. But, you know, whatever. I guess you have a vote in this democracy too.
God damn it. All right. Well, that's it, I think. Yeah.
Al Neary wants to take you fishing, Jim.
No, I'm not going.
You're not getting in that
I'm going to be Anthony. I'm going to head out to Reno or wherever they're going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. Well, it's been a lot of fun.
Yep.
This is one of the most enjoyable series of podcasts we've done.
Yeah, I think so.
Short and sweet. Not too short, actually, but definitely sweet. And whenever we get Godfather 3 in, I'm looking forward to it. Because it'll be either a shit show or I might be surprised how much I like it.
Maybe. All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Merry Christmas.